Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to have some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. For some time now, we have been studying the web of debt, which is essentially the shocking truth about our money system and how we can break free from it. Over the last several months, I've been looking at how our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been, in fact, privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing us of the value of our money. The web of debt really is a thesis that unravels the deception and presents a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are all heading. But it also explores a workable alternative, one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. What we're looking at is to find financial security, our own and our nation's and the world's, and that's what we have been dedicating this show to over the last several months in a series exploring the book, The Web of Debt. The Web of Debt is a phenomenal work written by Ellen Hodgson Brown. And I have to say at the beginning that the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles related to debt. I highly recommend the book, The Web of Debt, and her website by the same name. And you can also review all of the shows in this series at the archives, www.kruufm.com, under Life and Debt, specifically Life and Debt Web. So I'd like to begin with a review. I ended the last show with the question, who owns the Federal Reserve? The Federal Reserve is actually an independent, privately owned corporation, which is contrary to what most Americans think. It consists of 12 regional Federal Reserve banks owned by many commercial member banks who hold Federal Reserve stock in an amount proportional to their size. This is a very important fundamental point. The Federal Reserve is actually a private corporation owned by other very big private corporations. The Federal Reserve's website states ambiguously, quote, "Reserve banks are not operated for profit, and ownership of a certain amount of stock is, by law, a condition of membership in the system. Dividends are, by law, 6% per year," end of quote. Well, in ordinary parlance, a company with stock that is 100% privately owned and returns a guaranteed 6% dividend is a private for-profit corporation. 6% is a lot more than you'll get on your bank account savings. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York holds the majority of shares in the Federal Reserve System. That's 53%. The New York Fed's largest shareholders are the largest commercial banks in the District of New York. In 1997, it reported that its three largest member banks were Chase Manhattan Bank, Citibank, and Morgan Guaranty Trust Company. In 2000, for those of you who follow this kind of thing, J.P. Morgan and Company, linked to the House of Morgan, which we've discussed in the past, and Chase Manhattan, which is Rockefeller's bank, merged to become J.P. Morgan Chase Company, a bank holding company with combined assets of $668 billion as of 2000. That made it the third largest bank holding company in the country after Citigroup, formerly National City Bank of New York, which was another cornerstone of the Rockefeller Empire, and behind Bank of America. Bank of America was founded in California in 1904 and remains concentrated in the western and southwestern states. In 2004, J.P. Morgan Chase undertook one of the largest bank mergers in history when it acquired Bank One for $58 billion. That made it the second largest U.S. bank, both in terms of assets, $1.1 trillion, to Citigroup's nearly $1.2 trillion, and deposits, $490 billion, to Bank of America's $552 billion. J.P. Morgan Chase now issues the most Visas and MasterCards of any bank nationwide and holds the largest share of U.S. credit card balances. In 2003, credit cards surpassed cash and checks as a medium of exchange used in stores. By 2008, Bank of America had become the largest U.S. bank in terms of market capitalization. But the two largest shareholders of the New York Federal Reserve, where the Fed's power is concentrated, remain J.P. Morgan and Citibank, the financial cornerstones of the Morgan and Rockefeller empires. The Central Federal Reserve Board in Washington was set up to include the Treasury Secretary and Comptroller of Currency, both U.S. government officials. However, the board has historically had little control over the 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, which set most of their own policy and tend to follow the lead of the New York Fed. The first president of the New York Fed was Benjamin Strong, one of the Jekyll Island attendees. He had close ties to the financial powers of London and owed his career to the favor of the Morgan Bank. The New York Fed has some 500 member banks, and each bank gets only one vote in electing the Regional Federal Reserve Board. Yet, J.P. Morgan's current CEO still managed to land a seat on the New York Fed's board. Since then, the New York Fed has made a number of decisions that are highly favorable to J.P. Morgan, although there is federal law which seemed to forbid that sort of conflict of interest. So just in summary, it is obvious that the Federal Reserve is highly manipulated by the largest financial private banking interests on Wall Street. The guaranteed rate of return of 6% on the amount of money that comes out of the Federal Reserve then becomes astronomical. And of course, this is where the taxpayers' money goes, repaying the debt from money borrowed by the U.S. government from a private bank, rather than the government making its own money. In essence, then, the Federal Reserve is just a front for the large private banking interests. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So we see that the Federal Reserve is, in effect, owned by private U.S. banks. But there's also another popular rumor, and that is that the Federal Reserve is owned by a powerful clique of foreign financiers. But unfortunately, this cannot be proven from the public records. The Fed's 12 Federal Reserve banks are owned by American commercial banks, which are required by law to make their major shareholders public, and none of these banks is predominantly foreign-owned. That does not mean, however, that the banking spider is not in control behind the scenes. For example, according to Hans Schicht, the master spider has just moved to Wall Street. The greater part of U.S. banking and enterprise, says Schicht, is now controlled by a very small inner circle of men, perhaps headed by only one man. It is all done behind closed doors through the game he calls spider webbing. As I have discussed before, the rules of the game include exercising tight personal management and control with a minimum of insiders and frontmen who themselves have only partial knowledge of the game, exercising control through leverage, which are mergers, takeovers, chain share holdings where one company holds shares of other companies, conditions annexed to loans, and so forth. And then they also make any concentrations of wealth invisible. The master spider studiously avoids close scrutiny by maintaining anonymity, taking a back seat, and appearing to be a philanthropist. Before World War II, the reins of international finance were held by the powerful European banking dynasty, the House of Rothschild. But during the war, control crossed the Atlantic to their Wall Street affiliates. According to Schicht, the role of master spider then fell to David Rockefeller Sr., grandson on his father's side of John D. Rockefeller Sr., and on his mother's side of Nelson Aldrich, the senator for whom the precursor of the Federal Reserve Act was named. David Rockefeller was a director of the Council on Foreign Relations from 1949 to 1985 and was its chairman from 1970 until 1985. He founded the Trilateral Commission in 1976, and he was instrumental in convoking the 1944 Bretton Woods Conference, at which the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank were devised. He was also instrumental in founding the elite international club called the Bilderbergers. The Council on Foreign Relations, CFR, is an international group set up in 1919 to advise the members' respective governments on international affairs. It has been called the preeminent intermediary between the world of high finance, big oil, corporate elitism, and the U.S. government. The policies it promulgates in its quarterly journal become U.S. government policy. The Trilateral Commission has been described as an elite group of international bankers, media leaders, scholars, and government officials bent on shaping and administering a new world order, with the central world government held together by economic interdependence. Former presidential candidate Barry Goldwater said of it, quote, "The Trilateralist Commission is international and is intended to be the vehicle for multinational consolidation of commercial and banking interests by seizing control of the political government of the United States. The Trilateralist Commission represents a skillful, coordinated effort to seize control and consolidate the four centers of power, political, monetary, intellectual, and ecclesiastical." End of quote. So, as for foreign banking influence, the U.S. Federal Reserve can be controlled without owning it. In Tragedy and Hope, a book by Professor Carol Quigley in 1966, he revealed the key role played behind the scenes by the Bank for International Settlements, the BIS, in Basel, Switzerland. The BIS was founded in 1930 to serve as the central bank of central banks. Quigley wrote, quote, "The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. End of the quote. In 1983, in an article in Harper's Magazine called Ruling the World of Money, Edward J. Epstein called the BIS, quote, the most exclusive, secretive, and powerful supranational club in the world, end quote. The BIS is composed of 55 member nations, but Epstein said the real business gets done in a sort of inner club made up of the half dozen or so powerful central bankers who find themselves more or less in the same monetary boat. Those from Germany, the United States, Switzerland, Italy, Japan, and England. He wrote further, quote, the prime value, which also seems to demarcate the inner club from the rest of the BIS members, is the firm belief that central banks should act independently of their home governments. A second and closely related belief of the inner club is that politicians should not be trusted to decide the fate of the international monetary system. End of quote. The Basel Committee on Banking Supervision was created in 1974 by the central bank governors of the Group of Ten Nations. The Basel Committee draws its secretariat from the BIS and sets the rules for banking globally, including capital requirements and reserve controls. Economist Henry Liu maintains that these rules and requirements have diverted national economies away from serving local interest to serving international high finance. He writes, quote, national banking systems are suddenly thrown into the rigid arms of the Basel Capital Accord, sponsored by the Bank of International Settlements, or to face the penalty of usurious risk premium in securitizing international bank loans. Thus, the national banking systems are all forced to march to the same tune, designed to serve the needs of highly sophisticated global financial markets, regardless of the developmental needs of their national economies. National policies suddenly are subjected to profit incentives of private financial institutions, all members of a hierarchical system controlled and directed from the money center banks in New York. The result is to force national banking systems to privatize. National economies under financial globalization no longer serve national interests. They operate to strengthen U.S. financial hegemony in the name of private profit, reversing the logic that a sound banking system should lead to full employment and developmental growth. BIS regulations demand high unemployment and developmental degradation in national economies as the fair price for a sound global private banking system. And for those of you who are interested and have the time, you can see an example of this in a movie documentary on the economy of Jamaica, which is also called Life and Debt. And if you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So we see that international financiers can indirectly control the Fed even without owning stock. So its strings are being pulled by invisible hands behind the international curtain. Now, another private international club that is rumored to be pulling the strings of government is the Bilderberger Group. A June 2004 special by the British Broadcasting Company called the Bilderbergers, quote, one of the most controversial and hotly debated alliances of our times, end quote. Described as an elite coterie of Western thinkers and power brokers who have been accused of fixing the fate of the world behind closed doors, the group has been suspected of steering international policy and plotting world domination. But nobody knows for sure because its members are sworn to secrecy and the press won't report on its meetings. Secrecy has been maintained by using the bankers' monopoly over money to buy up the major media, educational institutions, and other outlets of public information. This control over the media goes back to the turn of the 20th century when Rockefeller bought up universities and medical schools and the Encyclopedia Britannica, while Morgan was buying up newspapers. In 1917, Congressman Oscar Calloway stated on the Congressional Record, quote, "In March 1915, the J.P. Morgan interests, the steel, shipbuilding, and powder interests, and their subsidiary organizations got together 12 men high up in the newspaper world and employed them to select the most influential newspapers in the United States and sufficient number of them to control generally the policy of the daily press of the United States. They found it was only necessary to purchase the control of 25 of the greatest papers. The 25 papers were agreed upon. Emissaries were sent to purchase the policy, national and international, of these papers. An editor was furnished for each paper to properly supervise and edit the information regarding the questions of preparedness, militarism, financial policies, and other things of national and international nature considered vital to the interests of the purchasers, and to suppress everything in opposition to the wishes of the interests served." That ends that quote. By 2000, half or more of the media business was owned by only six corporations, with directorates interlocked with each other and with major commercial banks. Historian Howard Zinn observes, quote, "Whether you have a Republican or a Democrat in power, the robber barons are still there. Under the Clinton administration, more mergers of huge corporations took place than had ever taken place before under any administration. Whether you have Republicans or Democrats in power, big business is the most powerful voice in the halls of Congress and in the ears of the President of the United States." End quote. In the work, The Underground History of American Education, published in 2000 by educator John Taylor Gatto, he traces how Rockefeller, Morgan, and other members of the financial elite influenced, guided, and funded, and at times forced, compulsory schooling into the mainstream of America. They needed three things for their corporate interests to thrive. 1. Compliant employees. 2. A guaranteed and dependent population. 3. A predictable business environment. "It was largely to promote these ends," says Gatto, "that modern compulsory schooling was established." We see that the robber barons succeeded in monopolizing the money spigots, the oil spigots, and access to information. But Morgan wanted more. He wanted to secure the bank's loans to the government with a reliable source of taxes, one that was imposed directly on the incomes of the people. There was just one snag. A federal income tax had consistently been declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. So now let's look at the federal income tax. So back to the wonderful Wizard of Oz. Again, it's the written version, not the movie version. There's a passage with Dorothy hard at work. The witch thought she would go into the courtyard and harness the cowardly lion like a horse. It would amuse her, she was sure, to make him draw her chariot whenever she wished to go to drive. Well, in the book, the cowardly lion represented the people, unaware of their power, and the harness that would hitch the lion to the chariot of bankers was the federal income tax. Slipping the harness over the lion's mane was no mean feat. The American people had chafed at the burden of taxes ever since King George III had imposed them on the colonies. The colonists had been taxed for all sorts of consumer goods, from tea to tobacco to legal documents. The taxation without representation led to the revolt of the Boston Tea Party, in which colonists dumped tea into the Boston Harbor in protest against a tax imposed by Parliament on tea in the colonies. In designing the Constitution for their new utopia, the Founding Fathers left the federal income tax out. They considered the taxation of private income, the ultimate source of productivity, to be economic folly. To avoid excess taxation, they decided at the federal debates that the states and the new federal government could not impose the same kind of tax at the same time. For example, if the states imposed a property tax, the federal government could not impose one. Congress would be responsible for collecting national taxes from the states, which would collect taxes from their citizens. Direct taxes were to be apportioned according to the population of each state. Income taxes were considered unapportioned direct taxes in violation of this provision of the Constitution. Interestingly, the absence of an income tax had allowed the economy to grow and its citizens to prosper for over a century. From 1776 to 1913, except for brief periods when the country was at war, the federal government had been successfully funded mainly with customs and excise taxes. In 1812, to fund the War of 1812, the first sales tax was imposed on gold, silverware, jewelry, and watches. The first income tax was also imposed that year, but in order to comply with constitutional requirements, it was apportioned among the states, which collected the tax from property owners. In 1817, when the war was over, the new taxes were terminated. The first national income tax, as we know it, was imposed in 1862. Again, it was to support a war effort, the war between the states. The tax was set at a mere 1-3% of income, and it applied only to those having annual incomes over $800, a category that then included less than 1% of the population. Congress avoided constitutional apportionment requirements by classifying the new tax as an indirect tax. It was a misapplication of the law, but the tax was not challenged until 1871. The delay allowed a precedent to be established by which Congress could bypass constitutional restrictions by incorrectly classifying taxes. In 1872, this tax also was repealed. Another income tax was passed in 1894, but no war was in progress to win sympathy for it, and it was immediately struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1895, in Pollock v. Farmers Loan and Trust Company, the court held that general income taxes violate the constitutional guideline that taxes levied directly on the people are to be levied in proportion to the population of each state. That ruling has never been overruled. Instead, the Wall Street faction decided to make an end run around the Constitution. In 1913, the 16th Amendment was introduced to Congress as a package deal along with the Federal Reserve Act. Both were supported by the Wall Street Senator Nelson Aldrich. The amendment provided, quote, "The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, without apportionment among the several states, and without regard to any census or enumeration," end of quote. And that was the amendment. Wealthy businessmen who had opposed a federal income tax were won over when they learned they could avoid paying the taxes themselves by setting up tax-free foundations. The tax affected only incomes over $4,000 a year, a sum that was then well beyond the wages of most Americans. The amendment was simply worded. The tax return was only one page long, and the entire tax code was only 14 pages long. It seemed harmless enough at the time. And we will continue in the next show. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.